All right, I see people are trickling in. So once again, good morning, everyone. My name is Claudia Moriano. I'm one of the stakeholder relations advisors with the ISO. Thank you for joining us this morning. Just have a couple of housekeeping items before we get started with today's session. First, a quick reminder that the ISO is recording today's session and we'll be posting the recording along with a copy of the PowerPoint presentation to our website under the path iso.ca. Grid-related initiatives, transmission projects update. If you have any questions about the ISO's use of personal information for the session or the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act, you'll find the contact information for the ISO's Director of Information and Governance Services listed on this slide. Now using Zoom, I'll do a quick overview of how we'll be managing questions today. When joining the webinar, everyone was put into listen-only mode, with cameras disabled and mics muted. Only our presenters will have functional video. Excuse me. There are two ways to ask questions today. Please raise your hand and I will unmute you on our end. You will then be prompted to unmute on your side. You can also ask questions in the Q&A box. If you see that someone else has a question similar to what you were planning to submit, you'll have the option of upvoting, which means the question will rise to the top of the list. Your name will appear on the screen, but your camera will remain turned off. If you're asking a live question, please remember to always state your first and last name, as well as the organization you work for. If you've joined us via conference call and would like to ask a question at the end of the presentation or throughout, hit *9 and I'll see that you've raised your hand. I will unmute your microphone. You will then receive a notification that will also ask you to unmute your mic, and you can do so by hitting *6. Again, reminder, please state your name and organization. Now, in January 2020, the ISO rolled out the Stakeholder Engagement Framework. This framework sets out the ISO's principles-based approach to our formal engagement with stakeholders and the important role it plays in how we deliver our mandate. Our engagement principles, as seen on this slide, are being inclusive and accessible, strategic and coordinated, transparent and timely, and customized and meaningful. And with that, I'll turn things over to Dennis Freelich, our Vice President of Grid Reliability. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. We have a fair bit to cover today, and so I just wanted to give a quick framing and context and highlight a few things for you. You will see through this discussion today that we are highly focused on optimizing the existing network and doing what we can to defer infrastructure until we are confident that that infrastructure is going to be needed. We will continue to use congestion analysis and milestones tied to sufficiently certain generation to trigger when we believe infrastructure is needed. It will be over 10 years since the last large transmission project was energized to integrate renewable generation in this province. And I think it's important to understand that 10 years has gone by since we did actually energize some infrastructure back in 2014 was the last date. We are sharing our conceptual plans for two new developments that we are progressing forward to the need stage. And we intend to be filing those two new developments within the next year or so. And therefore, we are moving with some urgency on those two, being the Edmonton and Southeast developments. For those who want to offer input and engage in any particular working sessions that we are going to launch related to those two projects, we'd ask you to let us know today or shortly after this session that you are interested in engaging in that type of working session with us for those two projects. You'll see we have some challenges in the southeast part of the province here as growth of renewable integration is occurring. We will go through those challenges with you and identify the risk managing options that we will be looking at to mitigate and manage those reliability risks going forward. And then last in this discussion, we want to provide clarity on transmission connections and transmission rights in this province, particularly as we're seeing a large volume of increased projects wanting to connect to our system. We want to be sure that parties understand what you are getting as part of connecting to the network and how we're managing congestion risk on a go-forward basis. So this session is about engaging all of you. We're letting you know where we're going, and we're looking to get your feedback and answer any questions you may have as we go through this session. Feel free and please engage as this is a good opportunity. You've got the right folks here on the call to go through any questions you may have as we cover the material. So thanks for joining us. I'm now going to turn it over to Ada Raymond, our director, who's accountable for our transmission system developments, and he will start us through the more detailed materials. Ada, over to you.
Thank you, Dennis. Good morning, everyone. So I'll start off, next slide, please. I'll start off quickly with a brief introduction of the ISO, who we are, what we do, and what is our mandate in the province. We are the Alberta Electric System Operator. We are responsible for safe, reliable economic planning and operations of Alberta interconnected electric systems. We are a not-for-profit organization created by legislation, and we have a public interest mandate. And as we've written here, we don't have any financial interests in the electricity space, be it generation, transmission, or distribution. Our costs are recovered from Alberta ratepayers, and we do collect a lot of information from the industry, from the generator side, from the loads. We talk to municipalities, the government, Conference Board of Canada, and we collect information from all of these sources and use this information for decision-making purposes and make our decisions in a consultative manner. We have four core mandate, core functions. We plan the transmission system out 20 years. We operate the electricity system, the transmission system on a 24/7 basis. We operate the electricity market, and we provide connections to load and generation with the transmission system. Next slide, please. And I'm on slide 7 here. I won't spend a lot of time on the objectives. Dennis just introduced the session to everyone, but I'll again highlight that the main purpose, the main focus of this session is to provide an update on where we are with the major system projects and identify the next opportunities for stakeholders to get involved in the projects, provide comments and feedback. And I'd also like to highlight that we would like to focus on our efforts to push the major transmission system out into the future. And in doing so, we are trying to save some money for the ratepayers while maintaining system reliability. And in today's session, we'll talk about all of these efforts and the challenges that we are observing on the grid as the grid continues to evolve as more and more generation and different types of generation come into the grid, new technologies show up. We are looking at all of this evolution and trying to manage these challenges. Next slide, please. And I'm slide 8. So the key takeaways or the key themes coming out of this session or today's presentation would be that in the recent past, we have made considerable transmission investments on the grid to maintain the reliability and support a fair, efficient, and openly competitive electricity market. Now we are seeking opportunities to push the major transmission system out into the future while maintaining reliability. And this is being done to maintain or reduce the transmission rates for the ratepayers. And we are accomplishing this with the help of optimization of the grid. We're looking at ways to maximize the use of existing system through our enhanced planning processes, through our use of flow control devices and different other means. But we are trying to maximize the use of existing transmission system and operate the transmission system closer to the edge. And if we have to build a new piece of infrastructure, we'll do so closer to the time when it is needed. And this approach will result in savings for the ratepayers in the range of about $100 to $150 million with the current suite of ongoing transmission projects. Of course, we are always open to your feedback, your comments, and we'd like to hear your feedback today as well. And we value your comments, your valuable suggestions on this new approach, and we look forward to receiving your feedback. Next slide, please. All right, so with that brief introduction, let's go into the project updates. The first project that we're gonna talk about is the PennV project. This is the Provost to Edgerton and Milram to Vermilion project that we filed in 2018 and got approval subsequently. On the right side of the slide, the single line diagram of the transmission system is shown. The proposed PennV project is shown through the dashed red lines. And this project consisted of two stages. And these are marked on the diagram. The first stage did not have any milestone. And the second stage did have a milestone. And in 2018, we had carried out, or we had prepared the need application using deterministic approach, and we filed it with the commission, and the timing was determined through the deterministic approach. We got the facilities application approval last month, with the exception of the Nilrum to Drury section. But in the meantime, we have done some additional analysis in our shop, and we have found that we will see congestion levels of the order of 0.5% when the level of sufficiently certain generation reaches 2,500 megawatts. Currently, the level of sufficiently certain generation stands at around 1,400 megawatts. And I'd like to just explain the sufficiently certain generation for those of us who are not familiar with this. Sufficiently certain generation is that generation that has either paid GWOC, the generator's unit owner contribution, or signed the REP contract. And so in our internal analysis, we have observed that we still have a room of about 1,000 megawatts on the current system before we need the PennV proposed development. And in the meantime, we are also in the process of directing the TFO to upgrade the 749L. This is a 138 kV line between Metesco and Edgerton at a cost of about less than $500,000. And this upgrade of 749L will also help us to defer the need by 2 to 3 years. Just as a reminder, the main driver for the PennV proposed plan was twofold. It was the load growth in the area, as well as there was a generation integration consideration along with the load growth. A recent 2021 LTO load forecast shows that the load in this region is lower by about 20% than the load forecast that was used in the 2018 need application. So as far as the load growth is concerned, we still have some time there. So load is not the primary driver at this time. And as I mentioned, our internal congestion analysis has revealed that we still have about slightly over 1,000 megawatts of room on the existing transmission system. So there is an opportunity to defer this by a couple of years, considering that the pace of development of the sufficiently certain generation that we have observed is about 500 megawatts per year. So that leaves about 2 years, at least 2 years of opportunity to defer this this project. And using this approach, we anticipate that we'll be saving about $30 to $50 million for our ratepayers. Next slide, please. So I am on slide 12. And this slide shows the results of the congestion analysis. The bars show the level of generation interest in the region, split through southeast and central east regions. The orange is the central east and the blue is the southeast region. And the dashed line, the two dashed lines, one yellow and one red, show the level of congestion. The yellow line depicts a scenario where the 749L is not upgraded. The red line shows a scenario when it is upgraded. And we can see that we see the congestion level of about 0.5% when the level of sufficiently certain generation reaches 2,500 megawatts. As I mentioned before, it was primarily driven by load considerations, but a recent review of the load forecast reveals that the loads right now are trending lower than what we anticipated in 2018. So load is not the primary driver for PennV right now. Next slide, please. All right, so that was about PennV. Let's move to the CETO project update. CETO stands for Central East Transfer Out Project. We filed the NEED application for this project in August of last year. It is about, the main driver is renewable integration in the Central East region. And the purpose of this project was to evacuate the renewable generation from the Central East region towards the load centers. And it consisted of two 240 kV lines from Tinchebrae to Gates. And if we had a public hearing earlier this year, and the project got approved in late summer of this year. And if you recall, we had talked about milestones. We had worked on milestones in the CETO NEED application, and we identified a range of sufficiently certain generation in our milestone approach. The lower value was 1050 megawatts, and the upper value was 1550 megawatts of sufficiently certain generation that would result in about 0.5% congestion levels. So this is shown on the left side of the slide here. And on the right side, we are presenting the latest situation. Currently, we have about 1,700 megawatts of sufficiently certain generation in the CETO region. So it is above the upper level of the milestone, which was 1550. So as we discussed and committed in our in the CETO hearing, we are planning to have to start the reaffirmation process, and we are planning a focused working session with the stakeholders to share our assumptions and the most up-to-date data with respect to the location, size, and type of generation that we are seeing as of today. So we want to share this these assumptions and data with the focus group of stakeholders, and we're planning this this focused stakeholder session before the year end. Next slide, please. And we will carry out the reaffirmation study, which is basically a condition assessment of the using the latest up-to-date data in early 2022. And we plan to provide the results of this reaffirmation study to AUC and publish it on our website. And we would like to invite those entities, those teams that are interested in this focused working session. We understand from our CETO hearing that CCA would be interested in participating in this focused session. But if there are others who would like to participate, then please let us know and we will try to accommodate your request. Next slide, please. All right, so that was about the CETO update. Let's move to the Chapel Rock project. And by the way, there will be, sorry.
Ada, Dennis here. There's several questions related to the PenV and CETO update. So maybe it's a good time just to grab those and answer those.
Okay, I will go to the... Can you please explain how the ISO calculated the $100 to $150 million ratepayer savings? So we looked at the capital cost of the project and the carrying cost of the capital and how much would the savings result if we delay it by 1 year or 2 years. And if it's 2 years, then we'll account for 2 years. That's a very high level response, but that was the approach. With the deferral of 2 to 3 years, what is the new estimated energization date for stage one and stage two? So at this time, it's looking at, I'm guessing we are talking about PenV here, with the 2,500 megawatts sufficiently certain generation threshold. So the energization date at this time appears to be 2025, 2026 timeframe, but we'll keep monitoring the situation and we'll keep doing our studies and we'll make sure that we zoom in onto the exact date in due course. But at this time, it looks like 2025, 2026. When is the ISO envisioning the 749L upgrade to be completed? As I've mentioned, we are working on issuing a direction to the TFO to start the work. My understanding is that it's not a huge amount of work, but Peter, if you can jump in, yeah. I think it's at end of 2022, but I may be mistaken.
Yeah, Peter? You're absolutely correct, Ada. This is Peter Huang, Manager of System Planning. Currently, the plan to have 749L upgrade completed by the end of 2022.
In ISO's preliminary analysis, how much additional generation can be accommodated before triggering CETO construction? As you know, the CETO has a milestone, and the upper limit of the stage one milestone was 1550 megawatts. And currently, the sufficiently certain generation level, as I mentioned, is 1700 megawatts. So we are already past that. So, and again, we will do the reaffirmation study, which is a congestion analysis with the up-to-date information and data. In that condition analysis, we'll exactly know how much time we have. But based on the studies that we did for the NEED application, we don't have a lot of room right now. But with the up-to-date data, we will use the exact location, size, and type of generation, and that may reveal that we may have a little more room on the transmission system. I don't know. Let's wait for the condition analysis results or reaffirmation study results, and then we'll be in a better position to know how much room, additional room we have.
Yeah, hi Ada, it's Peter again. So jumping in to probably answer the remaining question here, that's really related to the congestion assessment. So based on the work that we have done, especially for PEMV, indeed you're correct that at roughly 2,500 megawatt, that means we have roughly another 1,000 or 1,100 megawatt of generation capacity that can be accommodated. However, just keeping in mind that congestion assessment is very sensitive to the type of generation, the location of the generation, as well as the profile of those generation. So the analysis is preliminary in nature and really depend on those information. And we can obtain what we would like to do for the ISO is to use the latest information that's available so that we can confidently forecast the amount of congestion that we may anticipate on the system here. So I believe that addressed the congestion issue.
Thank you, Peter.
Before we move along, sorry, we just have Ed Duhal has his hand up, so I'm going to go ahead and unmute him.
Sorry, Claudia, I can't hear you. There's a
static.
Yeah, I can hear you, but there's a static.
Apologies. Ed Duhal has a question, so go ahead, Ed.
Okay, thanks. Ed Duhal is your DPAL consultant. A couple questions for you, Ada. The first is related to the connection studies that have included PEMV and CETO in their studies. And how is this change where you're deferring PEMV going to impact those studies? And how is the ISO, you know, going to accommodate that?
I will let Rob also jump in here, but when we do the congestion analysis, we are including a number of customer connection projects as well in the analysis. And as I mentioned, sufficiently certain generation will be included. And our preliminary analysis does reveal that we will not reach congestion levels until we have about 2,500 megawatts of sufficiently certain generation. So in my opinion, that shows there is room on the existing transmission system. So if a particular project moves forward with the connection process and gets connected, the chances are that that project will not see congestion until the level reaches 2,500 megawatts. That would be my simple answer.
Ed, Dennis here. Yeah. From a connection process perspective, it has no impact on the connections.
Yeah.
Those that are in the process will go through their connection work, and assuming they get to sufficient certainty, and move through to energization, there's no change in the connection process associated with that. What we're talking about is having confidence that those projects that are moving through the connection process actually get to certainty. And if they do, that's when we're determining the congestion forecast at risk once they get to that certainty stage, which then allows us to decide if we want to trigger infrastructure. We expect infrastructure takes about 2 to 3 years to get built. The sufficiently certain generation will take a year to 2 years to get built. And so all we're doing is trying to confidently time when to trigger that system project infrastructure.
So for a customer that maybe has an in-service date, let's say in 2023 in Central East, and they included PEMV in their studies, then they would continue to include PEMV in their studies, or do they have to now assume PEMV is not going to be in place in 2023?
Okay, now you're talking about the details of the study process in the connection process. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Let's take that one offline because I don't want to spend a bunch of time going through the details of the connection process. Feel free to connect with the project team just to work out those details as to whether to keep PEMB in or not. My quick answer would be, well, I would expect to just keep it in because you can assume it's going to be there on time whenever it is that the actual projects get through the process. We won't be pulling it out. We would keep it in, and it's just a matter of time.
Okay. Thanks. I got another question here just on, I'll connect with the project team on that. Another question here just on the savings. So when you've identified savings for deferring transmission and, you know, applaud the ISO because you've been very creative in getting the most out of the transmission system to connect these projects. So that's good. But when you think about the savings, if there is congestion on this transmission system from projects that typically offer in at $0, then that congestion will likely give rise to an increase in pool prices. And while there's a subset of customers, I think, in Alberta that benefit from lower transmission costs but higher pool prices, you know, if they're already long energy like a cogen site, most of the customers in Alberta only benefit if their total delivered cost of energy, you know, declines. So if we save some money in the transmission system but we cause congestion and higher pool prices, how does the ISO know for certain that, you know, the savings are going to be real for customers on a total delivered cost of energy basis?
That's a good question, Ed. So two things on that. The cost savings that we have put in these presentations, I just want to be clear on what it is. It is the net present value of the difference in revenue requirement associated with the timing of that infrastructure. And so we're looking at 20-year net present value as a way to quantify the savings of if we had this infrastructure in rate base, here's the revenue requirement. And if we delay it by 2 years, here's the revenue requirement stream, and it's the net present value of that difference. So that's how we've quantified the savings. As it relates to the congestion risk, want to be clear, the ISO is not planning to have congestion. What we are doing is we're planning to time the infrastructure on a confident basis as to when we expect generation to actually be connected to the system so that we don't have congestion. So we're not planning for congestion. We're using the congestion analysis to have more confidence as to when we need that infrastructure in place to not have congestion. And so as it relates to your question on the cost implications from a pool price perspective of having congestion, I want to be clear, we're not planning to have congestion. We're planning to time the infrastructure as close to when we need it and not early. So we don't anticipate to have any material congestion risk because we're planning to be there on time. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, you bet. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
All right, the next question is, what is the cost and time implication of the recent AUC decision to deny the Nailrim to a million portion? How is the ISO planning to address the issues raised by the commission? So we are still looking at a suitable opportunity to talk to the TFOs and re-engage them on this on their P&L process, but at the same time we are as we have just mentioned we are doing our internal analysis and looking at the up-to-date data and the new in-service dates. So in our opinion, we have the opportunity to delay the PEMB by at least a couple of years, as I've mentioned, and we'll work with the TFOs to engage them in their P&L process. and move this NILRIM to Drury and NILRIM to Vermilion section forward. Right now, we have time, so there's not a whole lot of impact in terms of in terms of need timing, but we'll see as we move forward on this. The second question is on the existing system, there's a RAS in the central east area that has 150 megawatts currently on it. Any subsequent generators that connect in that area will also be included in that RAS. With the addition of additional 300 megawatts will result in the RAS reaching the MSSC threshold. How will the remaining 700 to 800 megawatts of generation be able to connect? So we will be monitoring the RAS situation in the Central East. And if right now, we, in our opinion, we can manage it, but if the location and size and type of generation is such that there are reliability impacts, then we will take the necessary next steps on it. But right now, in our opinion, the RAS will have to be modified as more generation comes online. But if there is a reliability impact, then we'll have to manage it and we'll take the necessary next steps. Are the TFOs instructed to stop any unnecessary expenditures in light of the delayed ISD on PenWe? So, Dennis, you want to take that? We've been working with them.
Yeah. So obviously we've been in conversations with both AltaLink and ATCO on the project. They aren't moving forward with any expenditures at this time. As Ada indicated, we will re-engage the TFOs on the timing of re-proceeding with permit and license on the chunk that the commission denied permit license. And we'll probably be doing that in the Q1, Q2 next year, because that's probably the timing that we see to have to re-engage that process and get permits and license in time. The other parts of the project, they aren't proceeding with any work on those either, and they won't until we direct them to do so. So hopefully that answers your question, Dan.
Thank you, Dennis. And given that infrastructure will only be built when projects meet certain criteria, will projects in stages 1 to 3, whose studies show N minus zero and N minus one overloads, move ahead? So we are not preventing any projects from moving forward. Our forecasted levels of projects in the region reveal that we still have, as I mentioned, about 1,000 megawatts in the PenWe region, 1,000 megawatts of room in the PenWe region. So we don't anticipate any issues with projects moving forward within that room. And of course, as Dennis mentioned, our intention is not to enter the congestion space, and we will be moving forward with the construction of the facilities once we are approaching those threshold levels of congestion. All right. There are no other questions, so I'll move on to the CRPC status update, the Chapel Rock to Pincher Creek project. This project has been on our books for a few years. We've been working on it. Next slide, please. And it is primarily a plan for integrating generation in the southwest region. And it consists of a 500 240 kV substation connected to the Alberta BC 500 kV tie line, along with the 240 kV connection from this new substation at Chapel Rock to a substation in the Pincher Creek region, Castle Rock Ridge, or Goose Lake. We're also proposing voltage support devices like static VAR compensator and gap banks, as well as the series capacitors for voltage support. And next slide, please. But since we, over the years, we've seen the generation supply mix changing in the southern region. Initially, we saw a lot of wind interest developing in southwest, but lately we have seen a lot of solar interest as well developing in the southwest region. And so there is some diversity between the wind and solar, and which results in less urgency in the southwest compared to what's happening in the southeast, and we'll come to that in the next few slides. And we've presented a picture of the situation in about 4 years ago, in May 2017. There was some renewable interest, about slightly above 2,000 megawatts of renewable interest in the southwest, and we had about 5,000 megawatts of interest in the southeast. The current situation is that the renewable interest has grown. Actually, it's the total generation interest that has grown in the southwest to about over 3,000 megawatts. But the southeast seems to be a very active region, and the generation interest in that region is over 8,000 megawatts. So given that the generation mix is changing in the southwest, and given that there's diversity between solar and wind, in our opinion, there is less urgency in the southwest region compared to the southeast region. Can we go to the next slide, please? And so we have done some preliminary congestion analysis for the southern region, and we have observed that if we just take into account the existing generation and the sufficiently certain projects as of July, we did not observe any congestion on the network. But if we add 2,000 megawatts of highly probable generation on top of the existing and sufficiently certain generation, then we start seeing some congestion level, some congestion. It is still quite low at 0.25%. And if we add another layer of highly probable generation in the southwest and southeast, then we'll see congestion of the order of 1% or slightly less than 1%. So given this situation, in our opinion, the need for Chapel Rock can be delayed by a year or so. And so can we go to the next slide, please? And we'll continue to monitor the situation in the southwest as well as in the southeast region. And we are fully aware that it takes some time, as Dennis mentioned, to prepare a need application, get it through the regulatory process, through approvals. And then it also takes about 2 to 3 years to build, to construct a transmission project in Alberta. So we are fully aware of all these timelines, and we will consider all these timelines when we decide to file the need application. We were initially targeting early 2020 to file the Chapel Rock need application. We have delayed it by 1 year, and we intend to delay it by another year. So this 2 year delay will again save some money for the ratepayers. And when we do so, when we file the need applications, we will do so with the construction milestones and adopt a similar approach as we did for a CETO project, so that we only move forward and spend big money when there's a real need to do so. So that is the situation in the southwest part of our province, the Chapel Rock, for the Chapel Rock project. Can we go to the next slide, please? And I'm on slide 21 now. And somehow connected to that region is the Alberta BC Intertie Restoration Project. And we have been working on this project for a few years now. This is about increasing the capability, the total transfer capability of the tie line, and bringing it close to the path rating of the WECC Path 1. Currently, the TTC is 800 megawatts on the Alberta BC section, and the path rating is 1200 megawatts. So this is about increasing the TTC and bringing it closer to the path rating. And we have studied this project over the years. We are very familiar with the issues, the limitations on this project, and it is manifold. There's a frequency performance limit that limits the TTC. There's this Bennett transformer limitation, capability limitation, and then there are some voltage stability issues, the border between Alberta and BC. So we are looking at all of these limitations and trying to assess the situation. We are also exploring lower cost options for addressing some of these limitations. But an important factor in all of this is the Chapel Rock project, the CRPC project, because that also helps us bringing the capability up on the intertie. So Chapel CRPC project is a building block of the Alberta BC intertie restoration. And so whenever we are looking at the intertie restoration project, we have to look at a holistic picture. We have to bring in the Chapel Rock project into the picture as well, and find out the timing of when we need Chapel Rock. Of course, Chapel Rock is driven by generation integration consideration in the Southwest region, but it also is an important building block for intertie restoration. So that's the status of the Alberta-BC intertie. We are looking at all of these limitations. We are exploring some lower cost options, new technologies, and also looking at the CRPC project. And then once we are ready, we'll move forward with the next steps here. Next slide, please. All right, so it is again an opportune time to pause and answer any questions before I hand it over to Peter for the next stage. But let's look at the questions first.
Yeah. Hi, Ada. I guess I'll try to read out the questions and try to attempt to answer them to give Ada a break. It's been really a quick whirlwind to cover four different projects in such a short period of time. So I'll start with the first question on my Q&A window. And this is the question that does the ISO estimate that completion of CETO phase one will also be deferred, or will it be completed by the approved December 2025 timeline? So from our point of view, when we look at the CETO project, we sort of clearly communicated that the project is on a milestone, and the ISO would trigger the construction of the project once the milestone is met. So from our point of view, we are not seeing that as a deferral, but an appropriately timed construction based on the interest that we are seeing on the system. So therefore, there's no set time on the anticipated completion date, but our understanding is that you'll be triggered when the time is right. So the next question, sorry, Ada.
No, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So the next question on my screen is, in the response to the question on the RAS in Central East and reaching the current MSSC, ADA indicated necessary steps will be required if investment proceeds in the area. Can you please elaborate on what these steps would be? Maybe I'll eventually turn this to ADA, but I just want to quickly point out that the use of RAS, the utilization of the RAS, is actually part of our congestion assessment model. So if the total amount of generation that's wired up to a RAS is above MSSC, is being considered, it's being accounted for as a congestion event within our model. So you can be assured that it's part of our study, but perhaps this is the time to turn over.
Yeah. So I'll just elaborate on that, on the same thing. So it's not that we are going to miss anything when we do it. We are doing the congestion assessment. We will include these considerations in our analysis. before we decide on the next steps. And of course, as new generation comes in an area, we always review their impact on the existing RASes. And if we have to tweak the RASes, then we'll do so accordingly.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ada. The question that jumped in, so I'm going to go with the question that was on the top of my screen first. So the table suggests that in addition to Southwest Generation Project, the Southeast Gen Project influenced the timing of when CRPC transmission development will be needed. In what way does Southeast Gen Project influence the CRPC timing? What is the impact of Southeast Gen Project relative to Southwest Gen Project on the CRPC timing? Why does adding 650 megawatt projects on top of 2,000 megawatt project in the Southwest and Southeast more than triple the congestion? Okay, that's a series of great questions, and we'll try to address them in a holistic way. So looking at the congestion impact of different generation locations, CRPC's primary influence or driven by project located in the Southwest. However, generation project in the Southeast also has marginal impact on the need for CRPC, as the power tend to push towards the load center around Calgary. As such, overall, there is an interrelationship between all the project in the South, overall, whether it's Southwest or Southeast on CRPC. However, the main influence is definitely in the Southwest. So this is why by adding and considering projects located in the Southeast, it is part of the assessment for CRPC congestion. Now, looking at the congestion level, as I mentioned earlier, the congestion result is very sensitive to the location, the type of generation, as well as the profile of generation of the specific project that we model. So given the mix that we have based on our connection list, the study that we are seeing showing that 2000 megawatt result in a certain amount of congestion, while another additional 650 result and push the congestion much higher. That could be coming from the location of the last 650 megawatt, but also keep in mind that when we are talking about congestion, we're talking about the marginal last few hours that really pushes the flow above the thermal rating of transmission line. So towards the end, there's always a little bit of uncertainty in there. And this is why the preliminary analysis give us an idea that we are close. As we go and find the precise moment, it's going to be more challenging. And that's why we'd like to have that study completed when we have a clear understanding of sufficiently certain projects. I hope that overall answers that long list of questions. Okay.
Hold on. I think we just deleted the wrong question. So Richard Penn had a question there around timing of CRPC and intertie restoration if the legal requirement for the ISO to restore the intertie goes away. And so Richard, I'll take a shot at that. And then if Ada or Peter have anything to add, they can tag on. Chapel Rock, the timing of Chapel Rock will be tied to the timing of sufficiently certain generation in the region. And so we will only proceed with Chapel Rock when it's needed in order to integrate renewables in the region. We recognize that once Chapel Rock does go ahead, it does also provide some incremental intertie capabilities, but the primary driver for us is generation integration in the region. As it relates to 1201 line and the urgency to restore 1201 line, the legal requirement is, we understand it's in the legislation, but our decision to move ahead with intertie restoration will be based on reliability benefits, as well as any economic benefits associated with increasing the import capability on the tie. And so we're working the timing of that at our discretion, recognizing there's a legal requirement within the ledge to restore the intertie. So hopefully that answers your question, Richard. Back to Peter.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. So I think we have answered that question. And the next one, in the ISO's analysis, how much is CRPC anticipated to cost? Confirm that cost estimates serve as the basis for the two-year deferral saving calculation that provided on the slide. So the CRPC cost is roughly $400 million as the entire project. And that is indeed the cost that went into the cost deferral calculation in what's shown on the screen here. Okay. The next question, and I'm going to read it out, and perhaps this is something I'll be seeking ADA's help on.
Yeah.
In many high price hours, the frequency performance limit is more restrictive than the Bennett transformer rating on the voltage stability limit. What steps are being taken to, one, increase the effectiveness of LSSI service, to increase the effectiveness of LSSI services to maintain system frequency performance, and two, to increase interest in the program among potential participants?
All right, so as you know, we have started a pilot project for a fast frequency response service, and we procured about 20 to 40 megawatts of FFR service to understand how can we make this service, fast frequency response service, technology agnostic and let everybody participate in this. So we have just started the pilot project, and the term for that pilot project is 1 year, and we have two successful proponents who are getting ready to provide the service. And the idea is that once we finish the pilot project, we'll take the learnings and understandings of that of the project and open up competition for the next round of procurement to a broader community and let everybody participate rather than just the loads. So we are working on this pilot project and trying to open up the competition in the next round of procurement. That I think that answers the question.
I'll just tag a little bit onto that, Adam.
Yeah, okay.
So we obviously just went out for procurement for LSSI services for the next 2 to 3 years. And our commercial team spent a significant amount of time engaging potential players in the market to make them aware that we were looking for their services for LSSI. And so we did market that procurement fairly extensively. We did get some incremental players participating in that process. And so I just want to be clear that we continue to see if we can get additional providers into that service. And that's beyond the pilot that Ada is talking about to get more technology agnostic on the capabilities. That said, obviously the LSSI is a load driven service, and those participants, they need to actually be available, and under high price, if they're price sensitive loads, then they are not offering that service in those high priced hours. And we understand that that's part of the challenge and why we're pursuing more technology agnostic type of services to help us improve the overall capability from a tie line perspective. So hopefully that helps to give a little more context.
Great. Thank you, Dennis.
Can you please confirm what the units for congestion are in this presentation? Energy, time, capacity. So when we say 0.5%. That is the time, 0.5% of the time. Peter, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, Ada. So it's on the number of hours.
Yeah.
So each year has 8760 hours. And whenever we observe a congestion for a particular hour, we register that as an event. And we'll count the number of hours, and it's the result expressed in percent of time for on an annual basis.
Okay, in light of the potential for N-0 congestion of this, on the system, the ISO has identified that they would be filing a Section 15.2 exemption with the AUC when appropriate. In that situation, would the ISO be applying a last-in-first-off approach to N-0 congestion, or would the ISO default to real-time congestion management rules?
So on this question, Aaron, the ISO's practice is that we will utilize the real-time TCM rule, congestion management rules, to manage real-time congestion that we observe on the system.
And I'm just going to, again, tag on to this. The ISO is not planning to have N-0 congestion. We are using the 0.5% of the time as a forecasted future indicator as to when we are forecasting we are likely to bump up against N-0 congestion to determine when we need to trigger the infrastructure in time to have it there and not run into congestion. So we are not planning to have congestion. The Section 15.2 exemption, we would only consider if we're starting to see that we're not there in time. Yes, there's potentially some incremental risk at the energization time period of maybe a year where there might be some incremental real-time congestion risk. And in that situation, should that actually happen, we would use real-time congestion management to deal with those situations. But we are not planning to have any N-0 congestion. And no, there's not a first in, first off approach, either from a planning or connection perspective, or from a real-time congestion management perspective. We would follow the real-time congestion management rule should we need to, if there's real-time congestion occurring on the system.
Thank you, Dennis. There's another question on Chaplock seems to be on a net basis be a negative for effective intertie restoration. If the tie is restored, but the ATC is effectively used to import in wind to Calgary, then how is that restored? I'll take a shot. I'm not sure if I fully understand this question, but during the Chapel Rock explanation, I did try to say that, you know, you have to look at the holistic picture. There's this frequency response issue, then there's this Bennett transformer issue, and then there are some voltage issues, and then the Chapel Rock project comes into play. So you have to look at the bigger picture and then make a decision on how we move forward with the intertie restoration, because you're absolutely right. I mean, if one of the major building blocks is not there, the tie will not... the capability on the tie will not go higher. So we have to look at the holistic picture. I think I've addressed the question, but Dennis, feel free to jump in.
Well, I guess we don't see a negative effect for sure on intertie restoration if Chapel Rock goes ahead. Chapel Rock provides an incremental path off the tie line. And so we would anticipate incremental import capability if Chapel Rock went ahead. And so we don't see a negative effect at all. So I'm not sure we're understanding, Dan, what your particular question is. So if you want to to raise your hand and we can give you the mic, or drop it in a little more clear. We can maybe try to answer it in that manner.
Yeah, Dennis, can you hear me?
Yep.
Perfect. So Dan did put his hand up, so I'll just ask him to unmute.
Perfect. Go ahead.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Yeah. Yeah, I think the point I'm getting at is getting away from some of the physics and getting to more of the economic question of it. Is my understanding is the primary build reason for Chapel Rock is to help integrate the current and planned wind build out in the area. And I think somebody asked the question about the timing of Chapel Rock, and it was, you know, the answer was said it depends on how the build out happens of the wind, and that makes sense. But once that wind is built, it has to go somewhere. And you're basically interjecting, you're cutting off the intertie at Chapel Rock, and that's going to be a feed-in source for a bunch of that wind, which then either has to go out the intertie to BC or go up to Calgary to serve the load there. So when the wind is blowing strong in that region, or even middling strong, is the effective ATC that's commercially available to flow into Alberta not going to be limited because the remainder section of the intertie from Chapel Rock into Calgary is now going to be filled with the wind. So there won't be an opportunity for flows in the intertie to come in. So it's restored unless the wind's blowing. So I agree, if the wind's not blowing, there'll be more ATC. But if you look at on balance, the hours when the wind's not blowing versus, you know, low, mid, high and extremely high, I think effectively is actually going to be a decrease into the commercially available ATC.
Yeah, there may be an impact under peak wind conditions in the southwest region. But for most of the time, I think there will be increased capacity, and it is an important building block. We consider it as an important building block in the intertidal restoration project. So yeah, I mean, if the wind and solar are at their peak, perhaps there will be a few hours where the capacity will be lower, but for most of the time, I think it will help in intertidal restoration.
Okay, that's good to hear. I guess I haven't seen any of those results. Like, I mean, if it's something like if the wind and solar are at 95th percentile or something, that would make me feel a lot more comfortable. But if it's, you know, if they're at 70% or 80%, and it's going to effectively mean the intertie drops down to zero or something very low, then that would be concerning. Okay. I guess we don't have any of that data available to us. So if you guys do have any studies that show that or models that show that, it would be great if you would share those. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
That's helpful, Dan. Now I think we understand what your question and concern is. And obviously, just two quick comments on that. We are seeing a different mix in the Southwest. So it's not just wind, it's a wind-solar combination. And so that diversity does help a fair bit. And then we do recognize the increased renewables in that region. If Chapel Rock is in service, we'll have some, as Ada said, some hours of implication on the flows on the tie line. And we will factor that into our decision-making on the intertie restoration value and benefit as well. And so we recognize those implications. And yes, we'll take your request away as we provide more details as we get closer on the intertie restoration and CRPC. We can provide that type of analysis so that people understand the implications. So thanks for the question.
Okay, so going to the Q&A again. So going with the first one on the screen. Related to Dan's question, the ISO has previously said that it would consider DTLR to mitigate the impact of Chapel Rock on imports when the wind is blowing. Is the ISO still considering this?
Yeah, so going forward, we are going to look at all of these measures that will help in optimizing the system. So DTLR or flow control devices. We mentioned that we're investigating some low cost options, and those include DTLR or flow control devices. So we will be considering all of these to optimize the system. That will be the answer to that question. And then does Dan's question also apply to Mattel and Saskatchewan? The question was, does a high renewable impact the TTC on the interties to on the Saskatchewan and Mattel interties? That probably would be the question. It might, I don't have the answer. Peter, I need your help in the, for the Mattel. I think Saskatchewan, on the Saskatchewan tie, I don't think there's a lot of renewables surrounding that that location. So I, in my opinion, that may not be impacted. The Saskatchewan tie will not be impacted by high renewables, but Mattel perhaps will be, because there is a lot of renewable interest around Picture Butte. So.
Yeah, I'll say the same thing, as well as that the Mattel and BC interties, there's a relationship between the two. So when you impact one, there's also an impact to the other, maybe to a lesser extent, but there is one.
And guys, maybe we should be clear between TTC or total transfer capability versus hour to hour available transfer capability. So those are two different things, and the TTC will not be impacted as it relates to those interties.
Yeah, that's correct. Thank you, Dennis. Yes, the question is more related to the high wind hours and its impact on ATC on hour-by-hour basis. Thank you. Okay, so there are no more questions on the Q&A. And I do not see any hands raised at the moment. So perhaps this is a good time to start the Southeast portion of the discussion. Okay, thank you, Ada, for going through so many projects so quickly. So we are starting on the Southeast. So perhaps, Claudia, if you can go to the next slide. That will be slide 23. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you. Okay. So many of you are definitely familiar that the Southern Alberta is very rich in wind and solar resources. So definitely it's not a surprise that there are significant generation development interests in the South region, particularly in the Southeast. So what you're seeing here is a map showing the generation projects on ISO's connection project list together with the transmission system in the South. So I'll start quickly by taking you through the 240 kV transmission backbone first. And these are the lines that are shown in red in the diagram here. So let's start from Calgary. So Calgary on this map is roughly located at the upper left corner of the diagram, where you see a lot of gray squares. So these are the existing substations. So from Calgary, there are two main transmission paths, and one of them heads directly south to Windy Flat, and then the line turns east towards Lethbridge. The other path runs southeast from Calgary to Milo substation. And Milo is roughly in the middle of the diagram here. So from Milo, the lines run directly south, joining the other path at Lethbridge with a stop at Picture Butte. And Picture Butte is the Alberta terminal of the Mattel intertie line. There's also another 240 kV path that runs east from Milo to Castles and Newell substations. From there, three transmission circuits run north towards Central East. That's where we have the CETO and PENVI projects. And from Castle and Newell, another 240 kV double circuit lines runs east towards Bomanton substation and ultimately terminates at Whitla substation. And then lastly, this Castles to Bomanton to Whitla line is generally referred to as a CBW path for Castles, Bomanton, and Whitla. So most of the 240 kV transmission lines in the south are of double circuit tower construction. This means that a single transmission tower carries two electrical circuits, one on each side of the tower typically. So some of the newer lines are constructed roughly in the past 10 years, as indicated by Dennis earlier. And CBW is one of the newer lines. Each electrical circuit on the newer lines are roughly they roughly have a thermal rating of 950 MVA or so. And some of the older circuits would have lower thermal rating, but they are still in the 500 to 600 MVA range. So now if you look and focus on the CBW path area, you can see that there are a lot of projects under development at different stages. In fact, if you tally up all the projects, there are more than 4,000 megawatts looking to connect between Bomanton and Whitla. And there's about 1,000 megawatt looking to connect between Castles and Bomanton. That's more than 5,000 megawatt in this southeastern corner of the province alone. So moving on to the next slide, which is slide 24. So with such strong development interest and with some of the projects are reaching sufficiently certain criteria for the ISO, there's a need for additional 240 kV transmission developments here. In addition to those that are looking to connect onto 240, if you tally up the generation project along the 138 kV network between Bomanton and North Lethbridge, there are also more than 1,000 megawatt looking to connect there as well. So really, there's also a need to enable additional generation development in that area that's currently served by the 138 kV network. Lastly, as mentioned earlier, most of the 240 kV lines in the south actually have a double circuit construction. So in the rare double circuit contingency event where both electrical circuits on the same tower line are faulted, all the generation facility connected to that line will be tripped as well. And I'll come back a little bit later to elaborate on this and explain why this is a significant risk. Going to the next slide, slide 25. As more generation connects onto the CBW path, the Bomanton substation, which is a key location within the 240 kV system there, the voltage will start to trend lower as the line is getting loaded far beyond its SIL level. Furthermore, as the CBW path is a long transmission line, loading the line heavily with remote generation facilities can also lead to transient stability and voltage stability issues. So the two issues that I highlighted are M-0 and M-1 issues that the ISO typically investigates and provides a solution for at the time of project connection. However, the double circuit contingency, or sometimes referred to as a C5 event, is a low probability, high impact event that is unique here and is not typically covered in regular studies. So as such, we're currently considering different ways to mitigate this potential reliability challenge by exploring a few approaches, which I'll cover very soon. And lastly, there's another challenge in generation connection, and that is related to MSSC. And let's go to the next slide to cover the MSSC topic. So MSSC stands for the most severe single contingency. It is the largest single loss of supply to the power system it's the largest single loss of supply the power system can absorb without impacting reliability and tripping customer load. So MSSC is important as it is used to manage power balance across jurisdictions as well as reserve planning. Typically, it is the large generation unit on the system. However, a transmission line segment with large amount of generation connected to it can also be the MSSC. So if MSSC is exceeded, the instantaneous inrush on the intertie could risk tripping the tie and consequently triggering UFLS, which is under frequency load shed. So currently in Alberta, the MSSC is 466 megawatt under normal condition. So let's say that if there are three 200 megawatt generation facilities connected to a transmission line as shown in the diagram on the top here, this transmission contingency would actually now become the MSSC at 600 megawatt. So in order to maintain the MSSC at 466, the transmission line need to be divided into two protection zones. And typically this is achieved by requiring an in and out connection configuration by constructing a new substation at one of the connection points for one of the generation facilities. So this is shown in the diagram at the bottom. So as the transmission line is now split into two segments, the loss of each segment will only lead to a generation loss of 200 megawatt, thereby staying below the current MSSC level. So just a quick note here that MSSC is actually a very important topic. As such, the ISO has actually a full session plan to discuss MSSC on November 4th. So if you're interested and want to know more, please register on ISO stakeholder engagement website. Okay, now moving on to slide 27. So as mentioned earlier, the double circuit contingency is a low probability, high impact event for the CBW path. So let's think of an example here. So let's say there are 1,000 megawatt of generation connected to the CBW path. All 1,000 megawatt will be disconnected from the grid in a C5 event, in a double circuit contingency event. Immediately after the trip, this 1,000 megawatt generation shortfall will appear on the two AC interties Alberta has with BC and Montana. And let's say the two tie lines are importing at a combined 1,000 megawatt level just prior to the C5 event. So that at that moment, a total flow of 2,000 megawatt will occur on the two ties immediately after the C5. So the high flow will trigger line protection function and trip both ties immediately as the flow is far beyond the ties capability. At the moment, that means that the Alberta system overall is islanded from WAC and is currently short of 2,000 megawatt of generation. UFLS, or again, under frequency load shed, would occur across the province. And our preliminary studies show that UFLS is expected to be sufficient to arrest the frequency decline within Alberta. However, when you look at a system that suddenly lose roughly 20% of its load, overvoltage condition will likely occur in multiple locations. This could potentially trip additional generation units or other transmission lines and ultimately have the potential leading to a cascading condition that could lead into blackout across the province. So there's also one more note I want to highlight here is that a C5 event is fundamentally different from the MSSC event we just discussed. So MSSC is the loss of a single generation unit or a single transmission element, while a C5 or the double circuit contingency event involves the loss of two transmission elements at the same time. So the probability of a C5 is materially lower than a single element transmission contingency. So with all that said, understanding the potential impact of the C5 event, the ISO is currently investigating four potential approaches that you see on the screen here. And each of them has a very different risk profile. So starting from the left with the highest risk. So this is basically the do nothing option where the ISO would accept the C5 risk and continue to allow generation to develop in the CVW area. So next on the risk scale is to continue connecting generation projects, but limit the overall generation dispatch out of the CVW area below a specific limit during high risk period. So the high risk period really are times when there is an elevated risk of a double circuit contingency. For example, likely during heavy snowstorms. So the next approach on the risk scale is similar to the one I just described, but limit CVW dispatch below that specific limit all the time, since a C5 event technically can occur at any moment, not just during adverse weather conditions. And lastly, at the green end of the profile is the approach with the least risk, where the ISO would not connect any project beyond the limit and only allow them to connect after transmission development is in place. So those are the four approaches that's currently being considered, and we have not made a decision on the preferred approach yet. However, we're leaning towards the middle, as the needle indicates, as we try to quantify and better understand the risk as much as possible. So now going on to the next slide, slide 28. So we just talked about specific system limit. Now here's a diagram that shows effectively the limit on CVW path when considered in combination with BCM metal intertie import flow. Please do keep in mind, this is still preliminary information as we're working to further refine this highly complex technical assessment. So to prevent tie line trips, we really need to ensure that the flow on the tie lines remain within their capabilities after a C5 event. So as such, we need to look at the total combined generation on the CVW path together with the pre-contingency inflow on the two ties. So on the diagram here, what you have is the CVW 240 kV generation dispatch on the x-axis and the BCM metal imports on the y-axis. For any combination of flow that's below the curve, and that's the area in green, the tie lines are expected to remain intact, allowing the Alvera system to remain connected to WAC and maintain frequency response. However, if the combination of flows is above the curve, the tie line is expected to trip, leading to the sequence of event that was just described earlier. So if we dig into the curve, and let's say we have a CVW generation dispatch of 600 megawatt, there's generally speaking no additional limitation on the imports. They can go up to roughly the 1100 megawatt mark, just below that. However, if CVW generation increases to say 800 megawatt, 1000 megawatt or 1200 megawatt level, there must be a corresponding decrease in import from the AC ties to ensure the tie lines can remain intact after the contingency. So that's why this diagram is so useful in providing a summary to the relationship between the two. Now moving on to the next slide, slide 29. So the discussion we have had so far are really related to the near-term mitigations, solutions, and approaches. Now, moving into the longer-term solution, looking at transmission expansion, currently the ISO has identified three potential conceptual options for the Southeast. So option one, which is shown in blue on the diagram here, is a new double circuit line from Bowmanton to Cypress substation to the north. So that's the line, that's a shorter line that can help take advantage of the existing 240 kV line that runs from Ware Junction to Jenner and ultimately to Cypress and Empress. So that's option one. Option two and option three will complete the CBW loop by constructing a new 240 kV double circuit line from Whitla substation. So option two will run the new line from Whitla to Newell, which is the southern terminal of the ETO HVDC line. Option three will run the new double circuit line from Whitla to Picture Butte, and further a new single circuit line from Picture Butte to Milo. So the main difference between the three options is really that option one does not resolve the C5 challenge we just discussed earlier. Option one does provide a parallel path to the Castle's Bomenton portion of CBW. However, the Bomenton to Whitla portion is still effectively radial and is still subject to the same C5 risk. On the other hand, option two and option three can address the C5 risk by providing an alternate path out of the southeast area. In addition, option three also further reinforces the transmission path between Picture Butte and Milo, which is another location where we are seeing high transmission utilization. So moving on to slide 30. So this is a table that really summarized the discussion we just had. So I just want to reemphasize that option one really has the least transmission scope, and that's also the one with the least cost, as you see on the screen. Option two and option three are both, they both require much longer transmission lines and have much higher costs as a result of that. But of course, they are able to address the C5 issue, while option one cannot. Both option two and three also have the additional benefit of being able to provide additional transmission access to areas that are currently served by 138 kV network. And lastly, option three also has one more additional benefit of reinforcing the path between Picture Butte and Milo, providing further relief there. So with all the options identified above, we are currently going through planning assessment to further understand the different pros and cons of these options. So once we have more opportunities to flush out all the details, we will be engaging with interested stakeholders like you in a focused working session to discuss these options. This session will likely take place in early 2022. And as Dennis indicated at the beginning of today's session, if you're interested in participating, please do let us know, preferably today or shortly after, so that we can reach out to you later. So this is the last slide on the southeast portion of the discussion. So I'll take a pause here. I'm happy to take any questions. So I'm going to go to the Q&A window.
Peter, I'll read out for you.
Thank you. Sure.
The options two and three will help the C5 event. Will it not also exacerbate the risk of N-0 overloads on the 240 kV circuits west out of Milo?
Thank you. Thank you, Aaron, for the question. Yes. So as the southeast development brings more power to the Milo substation, which is in the central portion of the south transmission system, it does put more stress on the transmission path west out of Milo. You're absolutely correct. However, at the same time, we're looking at an integrated holistic planning approach where we look at the need between the southeast and the southwest. The way we understand it, southwest, we do have the option of CRPC. That's definitely an option that's under consideration, but also we can further develop other transmission solutions in the southwest to help provide relief for that pair of 240 kV circuit running west out of Milo. So we're looking to better understand that, and that's part of our additional planning study as we understand the capability of these options as well as its impact with neighboring system, neighboring as in the southwest. Okay,
who do we notify about interest in participating in the engagement?
Oh, that's a great question.
Yeah. You can send Claudia. Yeah, you can take that answer. Yes. And give.
No, let's do it this way, guys. We don't need it to go to Claudia. I'll just put in your response there, Rob, Peter, and Ada's email address. And sure. Those are probably either of those individuals, if you're interested in a working session. And I'm going to emphasize, this is intended to be a working session. So it's not going to be just an update information session. We actually want to get individuals who want to engage in either assessing the options we're considering, bringing forward other options that you may think might be viable, and working through that as a working session. So if you're interested in that type of a targeted focused working session, you can reach out to Peter or Ada, and I'll just put their email addresses in the response to Rob. And Claudia, you can put that in as an update to the session.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, we will have some updated information on our website where you found the information for this session. We're going to update stakeholders with what we've discussed today. Thanks.
Great. I think that's the two questions on my Q&A screen right now.
Okay. Have we answered which method would you prefer to be notified in order to be included in the Southeast Transmission Project options? Are we talking about email? Dennis just talked about the email addresses. Yep.
I think so. I guess we'll have, Ada, you and I will have our emails up there.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that's probably the easiest for now.
Yeah, agree.
And as you can tell, we are stepping out to engage earlier in the process here based on stakeholder feedback that some parties would like to be engaged earlier. And so this is our opportunity to enable that type of engagement. But again, we're looking for it to be a highly effective working type session where we can get people's perspectives on options, alternatives, and directionally where we're going to be going from a NID perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Dennis. So there's one more question here which says, why the short timeline to state interests? Can we assess this internally and come back later than today? Yes, absolutely, for sure. Please take your time as we, for the Southeast, we do not anticipate hosting the focus working session until sometime in 2022. So in any time between now and later on, if you can send your email to Ada or myself, that would be great. Thank you. Okay. I think that should be all the questions in the Q&A. Okay, and I don't see any hand at the moment. So perhaps we will be moving on to the City of Edmonton discussion.
Yeah, Peter, sorry, I'm changing my mind on the fly here. Here's what we'll do from these working session perspectives as we're creating it as we go. Claudia, we'll set up an email address for the Southeast engagement, and we'll set up an email address for the Edmonton engagement. And then we'll put that on our website, and people can go to our website. And if you're interested in participating in either of those working sessions, you can just provide an email to that address, and then we'll include you in the working session invitation. So that's probably the easiest.
Thanks, Dennis. And I see Matthew Davis has his hand up as well. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute him.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Just a point of clarification. In addition to the Southeast and the forthcoming Edmonton projects, Will there also be separate places for us to engage, or separate lines of communication for us to engage on the earlier mentioned targeted engagements on things like CETO?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Or I'll just, you know, blanket email you, Ada, you know.
You're most welcome. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, Matt. So we'll do an email address also for the CETO reaffirmation study, key assumptions, and then that'll help us to get the right people in that conversation as well.
Okay, and we do have one more question on the Q&A. So assuming there's time at the end and there are others who like to crawl into the weeds, could we have some follow-up open mic Q&A about some today's slides? Absolutely. We'll have one last Q&A at the end of the City of Edmonton discussion related to all the project updates that we have shown today. Okay, with that, I guess it's a perfect time to go into Edmonton. Thank you, Claudia. And if we can go to the next slide, please. That'll be slide 32, I believe. Yes. Looking at the city of Edmonton, the core of the city is primarily served by a 72 kV transmission network of underground cables and overhead lines. So as the lowest transmission voltage class, the 72 kV network is reaching its thermal limit in its capability to serve the growing load within the city. So in multiple LTPs in the past, the ISO has consistently identified the need for further transmission development in order to provide a long-term reliable supply into the city. So currently the 72 kV network has multiple operational measures that really enables the system controllers to reconfigure the transmission network after the initial transmission contingency. So with these measures, load in the city can continue to be supplied reliably without interruption. However, for the Kennedale substation in the city's northeast, the designed operational measure is also reaching its limit in managing thermal constraint. And that's why further transmission reinforcement is needed. In addition, there are the two 72 kV underground cables supplying the Kennedale substation. They are also reaching the end of life. So therefore, with all the consideration above, the ISO has been working together with EPCOR in the past few years to identify potential options in providing an integrated solution to address both the thermal constraints as well as the asset end-of-life issue. In the interim, a distribution solution of building a brand new feeder to transfer load away from Kennedale substation to neighboring substations has been identified. So this load transfer really allows the ISO to defer the transmission development in the Kennedale area by up to 3 years. So currently, we do anticipate the new feeder to be in service by the end of this year, enabling that transfer. So going into slide 33. Thank you. So what you're seeing is the list of all the options that's under consideration. So without going into much details here, we are looking into 7 conceptual options. 2 of the options, the first 2, involve the continued utilization of the 72 kV voltage class. And 1 option looks to rebuild the existing system using the same configuration with higher rated cables or lines. And the other option looks to rebuild the system, but operate it differently by closing some of the normally open breaker points within the 72 kV network. There are also a number of 240 kV and 138 kV options developed with various scopes. So many of these 240 and 138 options involve new substation to be supplied either from the north or from the east. So there's also one last option that involved the construction of a new breaker to complete the a ring bus at the Kennedale substation. So this option can provide one additional operational measure to manage thermal constraints. So currently we are completing our assessment on all the options above, and we are narrowing down to reach a preferred option. We'll be also again arranging for a working session on the option in the near future. And as we just learned, we'll be having email addresses available on our website, so you can register your interest. And once we finalize the preferred option, we'll be working very closely with EPCOR as a TFO in the city to prepare the NIT and FA filing for the commission. And we're looking to get this completed in the next year or two. So now that's the two slide here is a very quick coverage of the City of Edmonton project, but I hope you find it really helpful as an overview. So at this point, this will be the last slide related to project updates that's currently within the ISO. And that's the next portion is a little bit different. So I believe this is the time where I pass the time control back to Dennis.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. So obviously we went through a fair bit of various information here. So we'll just pause and see if anybody has any questions on any of what we just covered. Richard Penn, in your example on the nomogram slide 28 at the C5 risk versus imports, will this impact the ATC when the area has high levels of renewable energy? If so, how will you reconcile working on the import levels when renewables in the southeast will impact the ATC? So, Richard, I'll start with this as a response. As you saw, we're looking at what way we think is best to manage that C5 risk. And given the low probability of that C5 contingency occurring, but the relatively high consequence to the power system, I won't be interested in taking significant reliability risk for Albertans on this one. And so we will be somewhat conservative in managing that risk. And right now, I would anticipate we'll manage it more in the near real time, i.e. we'll allow generation to connect and we'll manage it based on the level of output of that generation on CBW at the time by constraining that generation in real time. Given that is where the actual reliability risk issue is, it's on the CBW path and impacting the rest of the province. So that's our current thinking on that. We're obviously open to any feedback, concerns, or thoughts on that approach. And that's why we're sharing here as we're going through the decision-making process, our current thinking. So,
thank you, Dennis. And there's a question from Bryce. Has ISO considered converting 69 kV systems to 138 kV as equipment approaches end of life to prevent future overload risk? This is always a consideration in our planning work, but at the same time, we need to make sure that there's a need to do so. If we can justify converting 69 kV to 138 or higher levels,
then we will always consider that in our planning work.
Yeah, thank you, Ada. So we definitely want to take advantage of the opportunity when it presents itself, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Does the ISO have any plan or timing to energize a second pole of EITL to increase its capacity to 2,000 megawatts? Or in other words, does the ISO have a trigger defined for this development? Peter, you can take it.
Yeah, that's a great question, Aaron. So at the moment, we definitely, the second pole can certainly be energized to double up the HVDC capacity. However, at this time, we're not defining a trigger right now to take us to the second pole, as there's energizing it will also involve significant costs, even though the line is already constructed. However, we still require significant HVDC converters at both end of of the line. So we have taken those into consideration, and at this time we have not defined the trigger yet.
Thank you, Peter. Gord, I'm not ignoring your question. It's just that we're trying to answer all the other ones because you want to have a deeper discussion on earlier slides. So I'll just address Dan's question. Regarding the statement that 72 kV underground cables are at end of life in the Edmonton project, what responsibility does the ISO have to test this statement? Or does the ISO simply rely on representations from EDTI? For example, is there condition assessment information being provided to the ISO for evaluation? Are those condition assessments correlated for reasonableness with recent operating history, say the last 5 years? Uh-huh. So Dan, I'll start, and Peter, you can jump in, and Dennis, please feel free to jump in. Yes, what responsibility does the ISO have to test this statement? Yes, we are working closely with EDTI, and our understanding is that a report is being prepared on a detailed report is being prepared on the asset condition assessment and end of life considerations. We have been talking to EDTI for the past 1 year, and we're waiting for that report as well. And then the responsibility is that we are, as Peter mentioned, we have a need in the same region with the overloading of the assets, and then the assets are also reaching end of life. So we are looking at the holistic picture here and trying to develop a plan. But yes, we are working closely with EDTI, and we are waiting for more information on the asset conditions report. And that will be an important consideration when we come up with a plan for EDTI or for Edmonton.
I'll just tag on to that, Dan. Obviously, the TFOs have accountability for their existing assets, and it is their obligation to defend their need to replace end-of-life assets. And so we understand that EDTI has engaged a cable expert in order to put together that condition assessment for end-of-life for their cables. And what we're doing is we will coordinate with EDTI on the integrated solution. EDTI will defend the need from an end-of-life perspective, and will defend the need from any new infrastructure perspective in that integrated solution as we bring it forward.
Thank you, Dennis. Okay, so we got two indication from Gordon that perhaps we can have a deeper dive on some of the questions at the end of the session. So.
And I've offered Gord that if it's more a philosophical discussion, then we can take it offline as well. I'm available to have a chat with him. Gord thinks that perhaps many of the stakeholders may not be interested in our discussion. So it's up to you, Gord.
And folks, we have Matt Davis has his hand up as well. So I'm going to go unmute him. Go ahead, Matt.
I think this is probably a question for Dennis. Just following up from your response to Richard Penn's question around the C5 risk and how the ISO is going to approach it, it appears that the risk is really shared between imports and the generation levels on the CBW path. And I just want to confirm that confirm what I heard, or maybe I didn't quite hear it correctly. Just want to confirm what the ISO's current plans are. Is it that they would be applying the TCM protocol on the intra-Alberta generation on the CBW path?
That's our current preliminary thinking.
Thank you.
And so obviously we're interested in any feedback on that directional path that we're considering moving down.
Appreciate it. Yeah, no, it's useful to understand that risk.
Okay, thanks. Any other, there might be another question.
In light of recent inflationary pressures we have been seeing recently, is there a risk for that the future capital costs of the Penwee project could exceed the indicated cost savings to ratepayers by delaying the project 2 years?
Aaron, I'm not sure what specific inflationary pressures you're referring to as it relates to transmission construction and transmission equipment costs. I think it's prudent for us to push out the timing of that infrastructure as far as is reasonable. I'm not a fan of building infrastructure early just in case there might be increased inflationary costs in the future. We have the expectation that TFOs will competitively enter the market. And right now there might even be higher cost pressures due to logistics and supply chain issues than there will be in 2 years or so when we actually enter into the execution phase. So we'd rather capture the savings for sure now by pushing.
Dennis, if I may add, I mean, our calculation for the savings do account for the inflation and other escalations in that.
And so those inflationary measures would have to be materially higher than what we're currently forecasting for inflation in order for it to have any material impact on savings.
Yeah. Thank you, Dennis. Gord, you can ask that question now or take my offer and take it offline.
Well, we'll just leave it for at the end. If Gord has more questions at the very end, then he can jump in and ask them. So we'll move on to the next if there's no more questions. So Claudia, if you can go to the next slide, please.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, we're just starting to double check. Gord does have his hand up, so I'm curious to see if there's something else he would like to bring up. Gord, can you unmute on your end, please?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes. No, I've got too many. Let's do it at the end so I can sort my technology out.
Oh, we've got a big echo.
Okay, just come back to us towards the end when you have it. I'll figure it out. Thank you.
Okay, so this part of the discussion, Rob Davidson, our director of our customer access group, is going to walk us through. Obviously, there's a lot of interest to connect to our system here in the province, particularly down in the south and central parts of the province and primarily renewable generation. So we just want to make sure the industry understands the approach we are taking as it relates to transmission access, understand our views on transmission rights, and how we're moving forward to manage the potential future congestion risk as incremental projects connect to the network and tied to both connection planning as well as system planning. So I'm going to turn this over to Rob Davidson, and he'll walk us through this, and then we'll take questions at the end related to this particular topic. Rob, over to you.
Great. Thanks, Dennis, and good morning, everyone. Happy to present here today. So we are going to shift gears a little bit and talk about transmission access and how we manage congestion. And this can Dennis talk about there is, you know, kind of why is this important to understand? Well, I think as many of you are likely aware, the congestion planning world is moving at a very fast pace right now. We have almost 300 system access service requests that we're processing right now, looking for transmission service. Specifically with generation, we have over 22,000 megawatts of generation on our project list. So with that number of projects and volume of generation, studies are becoming increasingly complicated. And many of you on the call probably are in the weeds there and see that. Specifically in areas where there's multiple system access service requests, within a certain region. Or it could be coupled with areas that have limited capability to integrate generation in a congestion-free manner, if you will. So, you know, that definitely refers, you know, if you refer back to the slide that Peter showed with all that generation in the Southeast area, that's just a great example of what I'm referring to. And the agility that the ISO planning team has had to do to look at a Southeast plan in that area, just because of the pace and change has come much quicker than anticipated. And in addition to that, I'll say, you know, over the last several months, I have observed just situations where, I've had to have some, conversations to help clarify with market participants, just an understanding of, transmission rights, transmission, within the framework within Alberta and managing congestion, or congestion risk. And so today's, I think, would be a good time for us just to touch on those. So Claudia, if you can go to slide 35, please. So I thought it'd be helpful before we get into that level of detail, just to highlight, and ground everybody, what are the key responsibilities that the ISO has as it relates to system access service on the transmission system. So, first of all, the ISO, we are the planner of the transmission system, where we are responsible to provide system access service to market participants. And we must do this in a manner that provides market participants with a reasonable opportunity to exchange electric energy and ancillary services. And to fulfill this duty, so the ISO, we have a well-established connection process. And that's what we use to facilitate our response to system access service requests onto the transmission system. And just on an aside, if you want some, the specifics on the connection process, I'm not going to dive into that here today, but please refer to our website. There is a connecting to the grid section on our website that provides, I think, a really good overview of that. Or if you have specific questions on your project, if you have an active project with us, contact your project manager, and they're always willing to help provide some clarity as required on that. And then, as we execute through our connection process, it's a gated approach where we study the market participants' requests. And I'm going to focus on STS in this part of the presentation. And ultimately, when the supply transmission service is studied, we'll look to land on a connection alternative that the ISO is confident in. That's the best solution. And then we'll also work with the TFO on the facility design component to that. And if that connection alternative results in an expansion or enhancement to the transmission system, then the ISO, then what we're obligated to do is to file a needs identification document or a NID with the commission for their approval. So I just wanted to highlight that, and just those are kind of the key responsibilities before going on to the next section. So Claudia, you can go on to slide 36, please. So I want to talk about transmission rights. And just so with that background of our, kind of the ISO's core duties, touching on transmission rates and supply transmission service levels within the connection projects and how we manage those. So I think, first of all, it's important to understand that in the Alberta framework, the commission has determined that there are no explicit or implicit transmission rights, or in other jurisdictions, they might call it reservations of transmission capacity. So we don't have that in Alberta. And the purpose of the connection process is to allow the ISO to respond to those system access service requests. So at no time in the connection process, or after a project is energized, do market participants have rights to the transmission system or reservations on the transmission system. So, as an example, as a service request is being moved through the connection process, once you've attained, let's say you moved into stage three of the connection process, or you've received your NID approval, or your project's in stage five in the construction stage, at any of those times, it does not reserve transmission for you. So obviously what that means is, you may have an N-1 RAS on your generation facility, or as we talked about earlier in the session, if congestion does occur in real time, we will manage that with the ISO's TCM rule. So kind of given that context, and you're probably thinking, okay, so now how does the ISO's supply transmission service agreement and that level, what does that provide for the market participant? And so, first of all, from a connection side, when we study the projects, we study them at their STS level. And what we do is we confirm the ability of the system to, we confirm the ability of the AIS and understand the impacts onto the AIS. Then we confirm the connection capacity to meet that STS level. So the STS level to the connection point is really what we're looking to confirm. And so we'll do that obviously through when we select our alternatives, and then ultimately the facility design is to make sure that the connection to the facility meets the STS level. And then we determine the impacts overall to the AIS. And we do recognize that, in the time at which we're at now, and you're seeing with the studies that we are starting to see the studies identify future potential congestion. I use the word potential congestion because obviously studies are based upon a significant amount of assumptions in there. And that risk as we move through the connection project, it is really a risk that the market participants have, given that there are no transmission rights in Alberta. And the congestion risk may exist, at the time of connection or sometime later, as supply and demand changes throughout the system, flows on the system can change as well. And so, again, let's repeat, if congestion does occur, we will use the real-time transmission constraint management rule to mitigate the transmission constraints. On to slide 37, Claudia. So I want to talk about our connection, planning and what that provides in the connection. So I guess understanding that there are no transmission rights and that we use the connection process to manage our response to market participants' requests will determine how to best address the market participants' request, including determining if transmission development is required. Now, there are situations in which responding to a market participant's request does not result in transmission being required. This is often examples of DERs or additional generation that is being installed, let's say in a phased approach to an existing generating facility. Quite often those do not result in new transmission. And those obviously, in those projects, there's no needs identification document that gets filed with the commission. And so when we do those studies, we study that at the STS level and we determine the connection alternative. And so that might be a TTAP as an example. It might be a radial line into a pod. Anyways, we'll determine obviously through our alternative selection on what connection alternative that we want to take forward to the commission. We also determine the capacity of that connection to the AIS. So we make sure that the facility design of the connection can accommodate the STS level. And then we also determine the impacts on the AIS, which may drive mitigation measures such as N-1 RAS to maintain system reliability. So we can go to slide 38, Claudia. And so as we're going through the studies, you know, we are starting to see N minus zero congestion in some of our connection planning studies. And so again, with the no transmission rights, there is a risk of congestion that needs to be taken into account by the market participants as you're moving forward through your connection project. And keep in mind that our connection project studies are deterministic studies, meaning that we study specific stress scenarios with assumptions on load and generation. And when these deterministic studies start to show N minus zero congestion, or if the deterministic studies are approaching N minus zero congestion, that's then when the ISO will start to use our congestion analysis capabilities to further understand what that congestion might look like. And so, you know, you're probably aware of it, that's where we're going to run 8,760-hour simulation to help further identify the congestion risk. And that's in terms of, you know, the forecasted frequency of it, the, you know, magnitude and duration of that congestion. And then that congestion risk will be used to determine the need for future developments. And so, again, that the Southeast is a classic example that we're seeing with this as projects started to move forward. We identified the congestion risk coordinated with system planning, and it's now led to, you know, a system planning development in the Southeast area in order to address the forecasted congestion risk. So that's generally how we're looking to address that. So just trying to tie this all together. Again, you know, there's no transmission rights in Alberta. The STS agreements, what they really do is they confirm the ability to supply the STS level at the connection point. The congestion risk, obviously, we need to, you know, we're going to manage that, you know, via real-time constraint management. So that's if it occurs in real time. Obviously, the market participants, you know, need to understand what that congestion risk is and take that into consideration as they're advancing their projects and progressing through the connection process. And then kind of from that, I just want to take the opportunity to highlight that the ISO internally, we've also been working on providing more information to developers in the way of transmission capability. And so we have an information session that's planned for later this year. It should be announced, I think, fairly shortly. I believe we're planning it in November. And it's going to talk about the ISO's transmission capability assessments and capability maps. And so this is really new. This is really, really exciting and new. And the idea is to show market participants at a substation level where, you know, how much capability there is to integrate generation at a substation using our congestion assessment methodology. So I'm pretty excited about that. So more to come, and encourage you to attend that session. And we are looking to launch that application in early 2022. So with that, I think that's the last slide, Claudia, that I had on here. So just at a high level, that's just what I wanted to touch on. And I'm open for some questions. I'm just going to pull up the question box here. So, Richard, in this presentation, the ISO was focused on building new transmission to connect generation. Is the ISO going to hold a session on how to actually incent generation to connect to the existing system? The last thing we want is an expensive stranded big bill.
You want me to grab that one, Rob?
Yeah, why don't you grab that one?
Okay. Richard, I'm not sure what you mean by a session on how to actually incent generation. Obviously, it's an open access within this province, and so generators get to choose where they want to connect on the system. We've kind of gone through the connection process, what you get, and the congestion risk managements, and how we're going to manage that from a congestion risk perspective. You should see that our congestion assessment and milestone approach is all focused on driving confident timing of when new infrastructure is needed. And so we would have no expectation of an expensive stranded big build whatsoever, because we would only trigger the infrastructure when generation has reached sufficient certainty, which means they are rolling to energization and the infrastructure will be needed. As Rob indicated, we will be providing enhanced information for market participants to understand where on the transmission system capability exists, to guide market participants to consider those locations where there is lots of capacity available, because obviously that'll be easier for them to get connected, and the risk to them from a connection perspective will be lower than if they're trying to connect to a location that has little to no capacity. And so those are the approaches we are currently utilizing. And so if there's something more specific you are thinking about, Richard, by all means, either raise your hand and grab the mic so we can understand, or let us know directly.
Dennis, he did go at the bottom. He added, I'm talking about the $17 billion big build we have already done.
Oh, so I'm not sure where the $17 billion number came from, Richard. As I indicated, the last time that we've built large infrastructure to integrate renewables was energized in 2014. We do not expect any new infrastructure to be energized until at least 2024, based on what we just went through today. So that's going to be at least 10 years between any infrastructure build. I don't think, as you can see with CBW, that infrastructure is already reaching its maximum capability. And so we're bumping up against that capacity as we're starting to see, we're bumping up against capacity in the Southeast as well. And as we get more generation that wants to move to energization, we'll bump up against it in the Central East and in the Southeast. And so hopefully how we are going about timing and managing the risk of when to pull the trigger on the expensive infrastructure will give ratepayers confidence that we're just going to be moving forward with it when we actually are confident we need it. And then as with any large capacity, it takes time for that capacity to get utilized up over time. That said, CBW, it took about 10 years and it's starting to exceed its capability already. So for a 40 or 50 year asset.
I do see he does have his hand up. Sorry. So I can unmute him. Go ahead, Richard.
Oh, hi, it's Richard Penn here from IPCA.
Hi, Richard.
By 2025, Dennis, we were supposed to have in 2014, the forecast in 2025 was over 16,000 megawatts of load. The ISO is now forecasting 12,000 megawatts of load. So we've got 4,000 megawatts of transmission built out there that we're not, at least 12,000, 4,000 megawatts of transmission out there that by 2025 doesn't seem to be used. On top of that, we have Keep Hills 1, Sundance 1, and Sundance 5 shut down now. We've got transmission all over the place. And all we're talking about here in this presentation is building new transmission. The question is, how do we actually get generation to hook up to the system that's already built? How do we get a solar farm to actually hook up where Sundance 5 was? There's 400 megawatts of transmission sitting there that's congestion-free forever. And how do we actually get somebody to connect there? The last thing we need, as loads need, is more transmission built and more costs. At $40 a megawatt hour, you know what's happening. And that's why there's a tariff. So the question is, how do we actually get generation to hook up to the transmission that's already built rather than just having it sit cold?
Well, Richard, I appreciate your comment. A couple things in that space. I think there's different perspectives of how much the existing infrastructure is utilized. And so we will go through that utilization conversation as well with industry as we engage in the transmission capability conversation in November and start that conversation. As you also know, it is an open market in this province. And so market participants, they have the choice. That's the construct that is in Alberta today. And so as an ISO, we are working with as best we can within the constructs that are in ledge and reg today to defer infrastructure out in time to when it's needed. And obviously, enabling generation in the province is an obligation of ours. And increased generation brings competition in the market, which is what we stand for. A fair, efficient, openly competitive market. And so we will continue to enable that. Obviously, the government has been in an engagement on the transmission regulation, and we, as an ISO, have been participating in that engagement, like I'm sure all of you have been, and we await the outcome of that transmission regulation and what the government is going to choose to do from a potential change within that regulation. And if there's opportunities with those changes that we can pursue as an ISO, we definitely will. And I expect that didn't satisfy your question, but that's the frame to which we are currently working in as an ISO.
Thanks, panel. And before we move on, Ed DePal has his hand up as well, so I'm just going to go over to him. Go ahead, Al. Ed.
Thank you. Ed DePal here with DePal Consulting. Dennis, when I asked you a question earlier, you said, you know, you're not forecasting any congestion. And then Rob gave his presentation and spoke about, yes, you might see congestion, and, you know, that's what you're going to have to deal with the transmission, with the current TCM rule, and the most effective generator will have to come off to deal with that congestion. I wonder if you could kind of square those two circles and talk about how they work together.
Sure. What I communicated was the ISO is not planning to have congestion on the system. And by that, I mean, we will, you know, based on all the forecasts, assumptions, modeling, we will identify when we are forecasting future congestion to be occurring. That could be 5 years out, could be 6 years out. It could be when we see this much incremental generation actually being energized on the system. And when we see that congestion risk starting to show up, and the metric we're using right now is if we see that in our planning analysis that we're going to bump up against 0.5% congestion from a time perspective in a future year, that's an indicator for us that we now need to move forward with planning infrastructure so that it's there in time for when that generation actually gets energized, that we won't have congestion. So that's the planning part of it. Now, obviously, with any planning, our forecasts might be off a little bit. Now, we're doing what we can to get as reasonably accurate in our forecasting, but we might be off a little bit. And so if we happen to be off a little bit, we might be a year early, a year late, and there might be in that future time period actual real-time congestion occurring because we're just not there exactly on time. We're not planning for that, but if we happen to get into that situation, we will deal with that congestion that occurs in real time through the real-time congestion management rule. So hopefully that explains the difference between planning and real-time congestion and how we're managing that risk going forward. Did that help?
I think I get it. Then you're going to plan your system based upon your best forecast, but you could be wrong. And if you're wrong, though, then the risk falls back on the generators. It's
as you understand in the reg, our obligation is for reasonable opportunity. It is not guaranteed 100% all the time, complete access. It's reasonable opportunity. And so we are considering the approach we're using as a reasonable balance of striking timing with reasonable opportunity. And that's what we're trying to communicate here to industry. We're not prepared right now, given, as Richard indicated, the transmission rates within the province, to trigger infrastructure until we are confident that it is needed. And therefore, we will continue to push the timing of triggering that infrastructure until we are confident it's needed. That does potentially increase marginally the real-time congestion risk that may occur on the system. And we'll manage that in real time should it occur. And obviously, if 5 years from now, we start seeing that we are continuously being late and driving significant real-time congestion, we will adjust our practices to be there on time going forward. But that's the approach we will be taking going forward.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Thanks, Ed. And Dennis, we have Matthew Davis has his hand up.
Go ahead, Matthew.
Thanks, Dennis, for the explanation to Ed's question. I think you sort of answered most of my question at the very end there about, you know, whether you would reassess this practice going forward. I think one thing that might help really assess, you know, this risk between, you know, the planning timeframe and the connection process and then actual operations would be to sort of really understand where the generator, you know, project inclusion criteria hits, because that's really, you know, what's starting to the where projects become real enough in the ISO's eyes. But then projects develop faster than transmission does inherently with the regulatory process, along with, you know, the long lead time aspect of that investment. So it might be really useful for us to, you know, actually have a good assessment of, you know, what this all looks like between the connection process, the transmission development process, the generation development process. So just more of a suggestion than a question, because I think you answered my question about whether or not you'd reassess this, you know, should we end up, you know, being always late with transmission?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll just take a shot at that, Matt, to kind of share our perspective there. And then if there's additional dialogue or information that would be helpful on that topic, then we're all up for providing that and figuring out how to share that. And I'll separate connection process project inclusion criteria from sufficiently certain generation in our congestion or congestion analysis, because those are two different things. In our congestion analysis, we are trying to forecast future congestion risk, and therefore we are incrementally increasing generation until we start seeing congestion on the system. And that allows us to understand how much incremental generation we can connect before we run into congestion. That generation, we assume, needs to be sufficiently certain before we would trigger infrastructure. And sufficiently certain means, as Ada indicated, the generators pay guac, which means they've at least put some money down and they're moving forward, or they've got a rep contract and it's primarily a binding contract. And so once that sufficiently certain generation gets to the level that we need to trigger infrastructure, we are embedding in that we need, it takes about a year to 2 years for all that sufficiently certain generation to get built and energized. And it takes about 2 years for the transmission to get built. And so we're timing that trigger to accommodate the different time periods between generation construction and energization and transmission construction and energization to help manage that timing risk. So that's how we're managing that congestion and timing risk and sufficiently certain generation. As it relates to project inclusion criteria, I'll let Rob explain the purpose of that because it's not related to our congestion analysis. It's not directly related to our congestion analysis. So Rob, just provide context.
Yeah, for sure. So project inclusion. So a couple things to remember on this one. So we have our tariff, and then we also have our previous tariff. And so projects that fall in under the new tariff, the project inclusion criteria is set at when the system access service agreement becomes effective. So from a transmission perspective, if there's a NID that's required of that, the SAS becomes effective upon commission P&L for that. And then sometime after that, there's a guac payment. So once the actual guac payment is made, I don't remember if it's 30 or 60 days after the SAS has become effective. Now, not to be confused with the SAS being executed. So the SAS is executed and guac evidence is provided to the ISO pre-NID filing. So that is obviously trying to help the ISO move those projects forward to filing with the commission that are committed with signing their SAS agreement and providing us guac evidence. So once it gets approved, it's effective, and then guac is paid shortly thereafter. Those under the old tariff, the project inclusion criterion under the old tariff was guac was paid and rep and or rep contract. So that's kind of the criteria of how it's used in studies, of course. So it's a planning, we use that as a planning assumption. So as you can see with all the generation on the project list, when we're doing studies, we need to find some way to reasonably dispatch the generation in terms of which generation and which projects are going to be effective should be included in the transmission study. And so we can't include all of them in there. And so what we do is if you're project A and it's your system access service request, we study you at your STS level. And then we'll dispatch existing generation plus those generators that have met our project inclusion criteria, meaning that the projects move far enough down the road that they've signed their SAS agreement is effective and they have P&L, so that's something that is pretty firm, and so then we'll go through an exercise of dispatching that generation, and then of course then we obviously study it given those situations. So it's a planning assumption for us to identify the impacts, what we think the reasonable impacts will be on the transmission system for that connection project. And so that's in general how we use that then.
Thanks for this, Rob. I should have just used the planning inclusion criteria. I misspoke when I said project inclusion criteria. Thank you. Useful info, though.
Okay, thanks. Let's see. So we're getting back to the questions here. So there's a question. There is a question here about as part of providing more information, is the ISO willing to produce a broader system congestion assessment reflecting all generation addition that have met the certainty threshold? So this question, right now where we're at is our transmission capability assessments that we're looking to launch. So, I'm excited to see that. So that's going to show the transmission capability at the substations. But at this point, we're going to be looking at the existing system as far as, you know, as far as existing generation. And then obviously there's some more questions about what about projects that have met the project inclusion criteria and or others. So I think that's all valuable information to market participants. And we'll, once we have the information session on November, we'd obviously love your feedback as far as future enhancements as we look to move forward. So obviously we're trying to provide information that is valuable to help market participants in their decisions.
Bob, let me just
add.
I don't know, we're getting
Sorry, Dennis, I think it's Rob's microphone. Rob, maybe just mute and unmute. I think you're getting feedback. Go ahead, Dennis.
Okay, good. From a system congestion assessment perspective, I just wanna try to explain how we're doing that. We look at the regions, whether it's the Central East, the Southeast, the Southwest, and what we're doing is we're adding incremental generation. Whether it's certain or not, we just keep adding incremental generation with the same type of mix, wind and solar, that we're kind of seeing in the connection process within that region, to see how much incremental generation we can add before we start forecasting future congestion. And we'll go above that so we can have confidence and understand how much more we can add and what we might have to do if we had even more than that. So that's the way we're planning, and we've done that with CETO, and we'll do it with CRPC and so on. And then we're setting our milestones to go, okay, if we actually get sufficiently certain generation at that level, that's when we believe we need to trigger infrastructure. And so we're always watching for, as the sufficiently certain generation in the region starts increasing, whether we need to trigger. And so all of our system NIDs will have that system congestion assessment milestone triggers to understand how much sufficiently certain generation we can accommodate. So I don't know if that clarified that process or not, Santi. If not, by all means, let's have an offline conversation on it. Terry, how does the no transmission rights in Alberta relate to the City of Medicine Hat being exempt from the Electric Utilities Act? I'll answer that this way. The City of Medicine Hat is connected to the AIS, and the City of Medicine Hat doesn't have transmission rights on the transmission system beyond that connection, no different than any other entity that's connected to the transmission system. So they obviously have the rights within their own city based on the EUA, but they are connected to the AIS, and as soon as they reach the connection, they have no transmission rights onto the network. No different than anybody else.
And Dennis, I just want to correct one thing. When I was describing through our studies that we study at the STS level, there's a little nuance where we actually study at the MC level, and where that comes into play quite often. In some cases, the MC is not equal to the STS. Sometimes it is, but particularly with DERs, right? So DERs, the STS is at the pod level, right at the substation. But what we do when we do the DER is we study at the MC of each of them. So I wanted to provide that clarity in there. So
if the ISO, so this is Lance, if the ISO experiences N-0 generation constraints, will that constrained generation be excluded from the calculation of the constraint rebalancing costs? I myself don't know the details of that, Lance. The way I would answer that is we would use the well-published transmission constraint management rule, and that would be applied to those generators that we need to constrain in order to manage that congestion risk. And whatever the mechanism is for costs associated with the real-time congestion management rule, that would apply. For Luis, in the session about transmission system project criteria, the ISO identified the opportunity for coordinated connection facilities when the ISO received SASRs from multiple market participants in the same vicinity. Could you provide more details as how to the ISO assesses these opportunities during the connection process and how market participants might advance this option? So again, that is an opportunity that if we see as we're getting connections in the same, and this, now we're talking really tight local area. If we see an opportunity, we would engage with the various market participants in a conversation to go, look, we think there's an opportunity to do a coordinated connection approach. There are some possible solutions. We will be in conversations with the market participants. We would only expect the market participants to be interested if the timing and the cost was beneficial to them. And so it would be through conversation at the project management level that we would introduce that opportunity and see if we can enable it with the market participants. We don't expect this to be an often occurrence because we recognize market participants have different in-service dates and different pressures and timelines. But we just wanted to recognize that the opportunity exists and we would try to do coordination of that if we saw it to be beneficial both to market participants and having less infrastructure on the landscape. In ISO's long-term plan, has there been provided any projection regarding potential renewable hydrogen production and supply? Marcus, in our long-term outlook, we've got various scenarios. One of those scenarios is what we would call a clean tech scenario, which has much higher, I'm going to call it renewable generation within the scenario. We're indifferent as to whether that renewable generation is solar, wind, hydrogen, from a long-term outlook perspective and a planning perspective. So should in the future hydrogen become more commercially viable and be able to compete with wind or solar, then it would be likely a substitution of different type of renewables. But we think we've got it covered currently in the long-term outlook with the clean tech scenario that we're studying. High enough volumes of renewables to be prepared from a long-term planning perspective. Terry's comment, the comment was no transmission rights rather than no transmission rights to the Alberta grid. Terry, I don't quite understand your distinction. So I can't elaborate further. If you want to ask the question, you can just put your hand up and we'll give you the mic, or we can just leave it, or you can reach out later. I recognize City of Medicine Hat has transmission that they own, operate, and control within their city. And so, yes, they do have that right. But as it relates to the rest of the network, they have no transmission rights. Ah, okay, thanks, Kerr. That's what you were getting at. Okay, understood. Okay, it's 11:44. We'll just pause a moment and see if there's any other questions that come to people's mind. And we recognize we've shared a fair bit of information, some of it more complex than others. I I extend the standing invitation to those that are interested or have further questions. You can reach out to myself or Rob or Ada, and we'll do our best to answer them. Our end objective is to be transparent and provide as much understanding as how we're moving forward as we can. And hopefully this session was helpful in that respect.
And panelists, I see Gordon is back with his hand up, so we'll try again. Hopefully his tech works. Go ahead, Gordon.
Can you hear me now? Am I coming through?
Yeah.
Without feedback, even better. And very nice to see Ada. It's been ages. I have several just sort of questions, mostly for clarification and curiosity on my part. I was thinking if you guys are done, then we've got about four or five that we wanted to go through. But I was thinking that Peter and Ada would probably be the ones that would be most interested or most helpful for us. But should we get into them, or do you want to wrap things up, or how do you want to handle it?
I'm available after this meeting as well. You're most welcome. If there are no other questions, Dennis, I suggest me.
Well, I think, Gord, if the questions aren't project specific, then by all means ask your questions, because those parties that are on the line may benefit from the questions and the answers. So we've got time.
Great.
Fire away.
Let's do it. For slide 26, one of the questions was, how common is a situation described in the slide where you've got independent sources of generation connected to a single line where you could have 600 megawatts? I mean, which would be greater than the combined generation loss would be greater than the most severe single contingency of 466. Is this a situation exists today, or is it a theoretical situation that could exist in the future?
Yeah. Hi, Gord. It's Peter here. This is actually something we're currently seeing on the CBW path as we work towards a few connection projects. So this is existing challenge during the connection process.
Right. And so, and is it the C5 that would take the 600 megawatts out? Could it be a single contingency that would take? So I guess it would be the single contingency that takes it out that you'd have. Yeah,
that's right.
Okay. On slide 28, I was thinking it would be helpful to sort of take that point of 600 megawatts of CBW generation and say assume 1,000 megawatts of BC and MATL import capability. And I was trying to work through in my own mind, and I was thinking, Peter, Ada, you might be able to help me. How do we stay inside the limits and ensure that the tie lines remain intact? Like, I was just trying to do the math and wondering how it all adds up, that we don't lose the tie lines and don't overload anything.
Yeah. Thank you, Gore. So one of the explanation here is the fact that the CBW is a very long transmission line. So with long transmission line, there's also significant loss involved when you flow those generation out to the load center. On the x-axis, what we're seeing here is the generation dispatch at the generation terminal. So when you look at the system as a whole, effectively the overall generation shortfall, if we have a trip, is actually the net flow. So with high losses, even though it's 600 megawatt, it's something much closer to 500 megawatt overall. We have a separate chart on this, but we just, for simplicity and for discussion, we chose to show this chart. So if you think about it that way, that's one major factor that affect the number. And then the other factor is also related to the fact that we are refining a lot of these studies. We started with focusing on our internal system in Alberta. The next step is to further refine some of our neighboring systems and model. And this is our next step. So as we do that, I expect the curve to shift a little bit. And then this is when we really get a chance to fully understand what the actual limit is. But this gives you a good sense of what the magnitude is.
Right. Okay. And just for clarity, the 600 megawatts, it would be one of the sections of the CBW path. Like, it would be Whitlaw to Beaumanton, or Beaumanton to his castles that would be going. Like, you're you can't lose the whole thing, right? Like you're just losing sections to it.
Yeah. Like it, I understand where it's trying to, where you're coming from. So if you look at the path, because it's effectively radial. So if you lose a section from Castles to Bloemington, there's generally speaking a requirement to also cross trip the Bloemington to Whitla because the underlying 138 kV system isn't capable to flow that amount of power that's typically carried on the 240. So you're right, it's broken down into section, but we take the worst case scenario, which is losing at the very beginning of that radio system.
Okay, close into Castles. Okay.
Yeah.
So with some of the options that you're proposing, and so let's skip down to the options slide, let me just bring up my own slides. I guess the piece that I was struggling with was the DC, the sizing of the DC were smaller than what I was expecting. Like I was thinking with double circuit 240 kV AC, you've got a fair amount of transfer capability. But for the option one, I think was 60 megawatts DC. Option two was 160 megawatts DC. And option three was 140.
That's distance.
Oh, it's distance. So what's the capacity that we've got? I was thinking okay. Can you bring up my error in seeing that? I was totally mystified as to what was going on, how you would be able to avoid the MSSC problem.
The DC there is double circuit.
Double circuit, yeah.
Okay. What's the capacity you're seeing closing that loop then? Is it the same in each case?
The capacity between at least option two and option three are very similar. So we are further investigating and coming up with a firm answer on that. But expectation is that for the existing CBW, it's roughly 950 MVA for each circuit. So we anticipate that the new circuit will be of similar construction.
And Gord, the option two and option three close the loop, but option one does not. I mean, it still leaves the part of the CBW line hanging radially.
Right. And so that was what was making sense to me, is that option one doesn't got the X for not solving the MSSC problem. But I was struggling with, I didn't see the sizing for the HVDC, and I was that was the one that I was embarrassed now that I didn't rig to the distances. So there it is. Okay, yeah, line length 65. Sorry, I just misread that completely in my rush. One of the other questions, sort of flowing down, thinking about the Pincher Creek area. One of the things we've noticed is that we're seeing potentially 3,500 megawatts really of active generation in the Southwest. And one of the issues that we've been wondering about is the location. And we're wondering whether we really liked. There were a couple of slides that were lots of good information on a map, like the where is the resource, the one that showed the where was this? What was the slide that showed the projects quite well?
Slide 23.
Okay. If we skip the slide 23. Good. So with this, one question was: is there any on that snapshot? Like, do you know when the page was taken? What this is reflective of?
Okay, I believe the question is: when was this produced? I think this was produced at the beginning of October. So it's not the latest on date point of view, but it's quite recent. And sure. I believe that's a question, because I think, Gore, your audio is really jumbled at this time.
Oh, is it? Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah. Is that any better? Any better? If I move my mic in closer. Isn't any better? Any better? What I should do is call in on a cell phone rather than using. Yeah. If the strip will probably calling. Sorry about that. try and do that.
So maybe, Gordon, since you're having a technical challenge here, maybe the rest of your questions you can take offline and just reach out to Ada or Peter. And we're almost done here for noon. Let's see, are there any other questions? Margaret, in the scenario on slide 26, is the cost of the in and out for the one generator a cost to the market participant only, or would the cost be distributed to all three of those MPs? That's a good question, Margaret, that I think we'd have to consider on a case-by-case basis to see. But directionally, it would be whoever is coming in last is driving the need for that infrastructure, would likely be the market participant to have to pay for that infrastructure. But that would be directionally where we would be coming from. The others, we would assume, have already got their connection alternative committed, because we're assuming they've filed NID, and therefore we've committed to their connection configuration. And therefore, if somebody's coming in after that, they would get whatever the next connection alternative would be in order to accommodate their connection to the network. And they would have to pay for that connection alternative.
Thanks, panel. I think, Dennis, we have about 3 minutes left. So I'm going to go ahead and just launch a quick poll. And then if you want to close us off with any remarks, we'll go from there.
Thanks, Claudia. Well, first, thanks for joining us. And thanks for the good conversation and good questions. Hopefully the material we've provided and the information and the discussion has been helpful. We obviously recognize ongoing conversation and dialogue is important in this, because it's complicated and challenging issues that we're dealing with. So stay tuned for other future information sessions and engagements. And we indicated, if you're interested in targeted working sessions, we'll have email contacts set up on our website, and you can reach out to us in that manner. And again, if there's any particular issues or concerns that you individually have, you can reach out to Rob or Ada or myself or Peter. Thanks for your time. Have a good rest of your week and stay healthy and safe.
Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you at the next one.
Thanks, all.